This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. With me this week, Miss Helen Needham.
Feeling autumnal.
Are you, by Jove?
Yes. Well,
how does that manifest itself?
Well, the leaves are falling
off. Bits keep falling off you.
I've been making lots of preserves lately, trying to use up all the fruit.
Why have you not brought any in?
Oh, sorry, I forgot.
You fell right into that one.
Yeah, whoops.
Speaking about preserves and things, earlier I came across a really unusual piece of, I don't know, is it medieval baking?
One where it eventually got out of the ground, you can see it's something special, I'm not sure what it is. Oh, it's, yeah. It's like gingerbread men.
That's an even better description of it, actually. Because when I saw it for a start, I thought, was that meant to be a cross? But it's not. It is. It is like. Certainly the one on the front looks like a gingerbread man.
I'm not sure. We'll have to see someday. It's a specialist in stonework to see what comes out.
You know, I've spent a lot of time in old buildings. Yes. I've never, ever seen anything identical to what we were talking about there. And we'll explain later on in this podcast. Well, we won't tell you exactly what it was, because I'm not sure exactly what it was.
And does anyone know?
Not yet. Given time, you
full
never know.
Intrigue and mystery.
Indeed. Right, moving to the natural world now. Just the other week, a minke whale was washed ashore at Inverbervie. Now, sadly it was dead, but it started an argument in the out-of-doors office about, what do we actually do with a dead whale? Who's responsible for a dead whale? What's the procedure? Colin McFadden for the British Divers Marine Life Rescue was the man with the answers.
So we're responsible for live animals particularly, but when something washes up, we'll go out, check to make sure it's alive or dead, and with the live animals, then we'll triage it, first aid, and ideally try and get it back in the water or arrange for euthanasia where necessary. If it's dead when we arrive, then we'll secure the animal, put up a cordon around it to keep the public away, and then arrange for SMAS to have an interest. And SMAS is the Scottish Marine Animal Stranding Scheme, and they take responsibility for all dead animals and a log of all strandings around the country.
What do they do?
So two aspects to it, really. They data log every stranding that we know of around Scotland. And also they take a very strong interest in the biology and the veterinary side of things. They arrange for necropsies, which is the name for animal postmortems, of pretty much any fresh animal they can manage to get to. They're based in Inverness, so there is a logistics aspect to that. And for other animals, they have a network of voluntary samplers around the country, people who can go out and take tissue samples and then and seal those and deal with them appropriately.
What's the logic behind keeping the public away from the carcasses? Because people are understandably curious.
It's a public health issue as much as anything. Live animals have quite a lot of diseases that can be passed on to humans, which don't necessarily affect the animals in the first place. Salmonella, Campylobacter, Brucella, various pneumonias can be affected from them. So there's a lot of zoonotic infections. And the fact the animal has come ashore could be an indication that it's suffering from something as well that can be passed on. Seals being another one, if they don't pass things on to humans, they can pass things on to dogs and other animals as well. So it very much is a public safety cordon.
I remember quite a few years ago being called to St. Cyrus Beach, and there were 5 sperm whales. Now, I reckon I got there 10 hours after it happened. I've got quite a strong stomach. This was not for the faint-hearted. They were honking.
Sperm whales particularly decompose fast, and
that's unbelievable, in 10 hours.
Yes, and they inflate with the decomposition gases, so if they're not dealt with appropriately, there is an explosion risk.
Once you've attended to it, once SMAS have done what they need to do, who's responsible for the carcass? I mean, how heavy animals are we talking about?
Well, that varies. I mean, we deal with everything from seals up to the great whales, so you're talking about an 8-kilogram seal, if it's a malnourished pup, up to a fin whale 72 ton.
What do you do with 72 tons of decomposing meat?
That's essentially it's actually up to the local council, and every council's got their own strategy for dealing with it, but it depends on how the animal's died. If it's died naturally, then that's up to the council to decide. It's same as if it's been put down by shot or some sort of euthanasia that way. If it's been put down by drugs, a dolphin, seal, or a small whale, then that has to be regarded as controlled or hazardous waste, and there's a much stricter regime of what happens to that, and that must be removed from the beach, because any scavengers on the beach, birds, and essentially fish if it goes back in the water, will then be affected by the drugs that it's been put down with.
How do you get, say, 50 tonnes of animal off a beach or under a beach?
Well, as I said, that is a strategy the councils themselves will deal with. There have certainly been a few councils in the recent past that have decided to bury an animal on the beach and bring in heavy plant, 20-foot pole or so, and then roll it in. That's quite strenuous activity, as you can imagine, for something of, a sperm whale size. For others, then dismemberment on the
beach.
So
they take it, that's really what I was getting at. They take it to bits.
They have certainly had had large animals taken apart and removed from the beach, either to a controlled landfill or to incineration.
Are you seeing any change in which kind of whales are stranding themselves or where they're stranding themselves?
We're certainly, at the moment, seeing a dramatic increase in the number of call-outs we've got, both whales and seals.
Why?
I don't think we've got enough data to definitely say why. There will be an element of better reporting and people more interested in actually telling us about it, so that'll certainly increase the numbers. The first 6 months of this year, we did more rescues than we did in 2016 entirely. Mm-hmm. So it's a quite dramatic increase. In terms of actual species, there is an increase in some of the species we'd have said were rare previously, so Sowerby's beaked whales, Cuvier's beaked whales, even things like the pygmy sperm whale are supposed to be tropical animals, and we've seen five or six of them in the past 10 years or so. That might not seem a huge amount, but given that they, according to the books, they don't come outside the tropics at all, that's quite significant.
Is there anything we are doing offshore that would confuse the animals? I mean, you say there's not enough data to say conclusively, yeah. But I mean, what's your instinct?
Theoretically, in that sense, yes. A lot of what we do is putting noise into the water, and toothed whales particularly obviously rely on sonar to be able to navigate. So there's very much a risk of increasing the chances of strandings because of this. Seismic vessels, increase in number of vessels, even offshore wind farms, the actual drilling to create bases for those can all increase the amount of noise in the water, which can increase disturbance. We know we have some strandings that are entirely natural, but that just means there will be some that are entirely artificial as well, and probably some that are a bit of a mixture of both.
To a certain extent, what we've been discussing so far is kind of locking the stable door after the horse has bolted. Is there a way of preventing the animals stranding themselves in the first place?
Certainly for some animals. The great whales, for instance, once they're on a beach, 72 tonne for a fin whale, that's quite difficult to move at that point. So one of the strategies we've worked out in relation with other organisations around the world is to actually go out and try and help them before they strand. In fact, a lot of animals in general in the water have problems because of entanglements. So even from seals on the beaches around here with fishing net around their necks, up to humpbacks and minke whales that are towing lobster creels or other entanglements. So British Divers and Marine Life Rescue's got the only large whale disentanglement team in Europe. And what that does is, when we're alerted to animals entangled in water, we'll actually go out into the open sea and come up behind large whales and cut them free at sea before they get entangled and stranded.
Have you done that?
I'm on the team, yes. And it's,
what is that? What's that like, being in the water with something that big?
It's scary. It's probably the easiest part of it. We've said before, it's the most dangerous thing we'll probably do outside of actual combat. You think of the size of the animal and the relative size of a very small rubber boat. It's something we're trained in by Americans. It turns out they are the world's experts in this field.
What kind of gear do you use to free a whale?
very, very sharp knives. And given most of the ropes that fishers use these days are steel cored, there has to be a knife that can cut this at pretty much one pull. And again, given the size of the animals, these are quite often on 3-4 meter long poles in a, as I said, very small rubber boat. So there's very specialised gear.
There's always a risk of anthropomorphising something as intelligent as a whale.
Yes.
But have you ever done that and thought to yourself, this animal now knows what I'm trying to do?
Yes.
Seriously?
Absolutely. And whether you're right or wrong with that, I think when we're on a beach with live animals, pilot whales, good example, because when they come ashore, we end up with a large number of them, and it can take a while, an entire tide cycle, to get them back out. So we've been on the beach for 16 hours or so with animals, and you do end up empathising with them, and certainly they do seem to understand what you're trying to do for them and to a certain degree work with you. How much of that is real and how much of that is just anthropomorphising is hard to tell, but there certainly seems to be a little bit of understanding there anyway across the species.
Colin McFadden of the British Divers Marine Life Rescue. That must be an extraordinary experience.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to help something that large, to be that close, to have that moment of tension where you think, does this thing get what I'm trying to do here? Or is it CB trying to attack it? Or, you know.
Yeah, well, there's an author, a guy called Philip Hoare, H-O-A-R-E, who writes extensively about whales. He's actually someone who goes swimming in the sea every single day of the year, mm-hmm. wherever he is mm-hmm. in the world. And I interviewed him at the Edinburgh International Book Festival a few years ago, and he told me about his experience of swimming with sperm whales mm-hmm. in the Azores. And he said there is a recognition
yes.
between you and the whale. It's like they understand there's some sort of mammalian connection.
I mean, this is not nearly so empathetic, but the author of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, when he was a medical student, actually spent a season aboard a Peterhead whaler as the medical officer, as the ship's surgeon, essentially. But being a very active individual, he actually took to the whaling boats too. And the following year, they tried sending him back on again as ship's surgeon stroke harpooner, because he was a big, strong man. But he wrote very movingly about killing a whale and seeing the light extinguish in his eyes. And he talks about the sort of mute exposition in his eyes. It's a phrase that stuck with me all over the years. We were talking there about, I think I said to Colin that I had seen 5 dead sperm whales on St. Cyrus Beach. And it wasn't St. Cyrus Beach, it was Cruden Bay. And the guy I was with at that point, talking about these animals, was Bob Davis, an old friend of this programme. Bob sadly passed away just over a week ago. He was warden at Forvey Nature Reserve for 18 years and latterly a leading member of the River Eithen Project Group.
In fact, in April this year, Ewan Ewan traced that very river, the Eithen in Aberdeenshire, from its source to sea in the expert company of Bob. Mm-hmm. And here's a clip of that programme just when you've reached the grounds of Fyvie Castle.
Just coming along the side of the loch there, there was grey heron, there's obviously this mute swan, yeah. moorhen. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of the wildlife on the Eithen, what is there?
Oh, tons of the stuff you've just mentioned.
Beat it off with a stick.
You've mentioned a few things. I mean, one thing you haven't mentioned, of course, are the things that are actually in the river, the fish. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's always been recognised as a very good fishing river, both not just for salmon, but both for salmon and sea trout, and brown trout as well. I think the largest salmon supposed to have been about 19 kilos. That was back in 18-something by a Dr. Fowler from Ellen. But then someone found one dead, and I reckon it weighed about 25 and a half kilos.
Whoa.
But I think if you got one at sort of 4 or 5 kilos today, you'd be lucky. The other thing that's interesting that you get in the river, most people don't know anything about, are lampreys. Mm-hmm. Vampire fish, you know.
That's nasty. Undersell it, go on. They're a nasty little thing.
Well, that's it, yeah. I mean, some people call them vampire fish because what they do is they attach themselves to other fish and they've got a circular mouth with teeth and they bite into them and feed off the fish. Uh-huh. So they're really weird-looking things. They're a bit eel-like in shape. And, of course, they don't have gills because they're stuck to another fish. They don't have gills. They've got rows of holes just at the back of the mouth for taking in and expelling water.
But I was looking at there's a swan nesting over there. There's a coot, the moorhen.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Will you just have a listen for a couple of seconds? There's a lot going on there, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, pheasants,
robins,
yeah,
wood pigeon. We were saying earlier, I mean, the Eithin is not a major river in this area. We've got bigger ones. We've got the Devon, we've got the Don, we've got the Dee, that kind of thing. But what always fascinates me about river, just thinking of it historically, in the past they were used for energy. In the past they were used for transportation. I mean, the number of mills it must have been on this river, 35 miles long or not.
If you look on a map, I mean, everything you look at is mill of this, little mill, big mill, small mill, a mill town of this, yeah. Mill town everywhere. But yeah, of course, people use the river. But one thing, I mean, you started off talking about the Roman camp up by Eithin Wells, but one thing the river was a route of access to early man. It was starting off at the top end of the river and going down to the sea, whereas in point of fact, man's occupation of the area started at the bottom and worked its way up. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first occupants of this area were what known as strand loopers. They used to come up the coast, up the strand, because that was the only point of access. I mean, looking at all the trees around here, you imagine 8,000 years ago, this was part of the largest oak forest in the Northern Hemisphere. If you was a squirrel, you could have got on a tree at Bodham and got off a tree at Ardnamurchan, and that would have been it. It was incredible. So rivers, the coast, of course, and then rivers made a point of access. So they really used the Eithin as a road.
The late and much lamented Bob Davis there. I know Bob had a host of friends all over Scotland. He was very, very well known, and he will be sadly missed. If you'd like to hear the whole of that River Eithin programme, it is available as a podcast at Scotland Outdoors.
Lackey from Troon texted into our live programme, which is Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. He said, sad news about Bob Davis. I grew up in Udney and remember his enthusiasm when he took us into Forvie Sands in primary school. His enthusiasm stayed with me, and years later I became a biology teacher. Interestingly, as a young man, he was in a Tom Weir episode.
Now that I didn't know. That's interesting. What if it's possible still to retrieve that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that surprising, really, someone so knowledgeable and enthusiastic.
Yeah. No, I spent a very pleasant evening with one time and on the Eithin estuary, just at Newborough, and we were trying to record the sounds of the estuary at night, and it was his suggestion. But we'd built a fire, and we'd have a bottle of whiskey, and we were sitting there getting a bit stupid, and he suddenly said, apropos of nothing, I tried ham of badger once. I said, what, ham of badger? He says, yes. In an old book about how to prepare roadkill. He says, and I found this freshly killed badger, says, and I cut the ham off it, you know, hindquarters off it, says, and I smoked it up the chimney in my house. He says, and then I ate it. And I said, what on earth did it taste like? And there was a long pause, and he went, very badgery. Thanks, Davis. That's really useful.
Yeah, I can't say I'm attracted to eating badger.
Well, I don't know. I have no idea what it tastes like. It's left me curious.
Yeah, none the wiser.
Sure. We've spoken about this issue umpteen times on BBC Radio Scotland's live programme Out of Doors. But if you look at the Scottish farming population, a lot of the people with farms are becoming quite elderly. And the young people can't access farms, so there's a serious issue there. Patrick and Jess Kimpton are young farmers who have really struggled to purchase a farm, but thanks to a new scheme the Scottish Government is rolling out countrywide, they've now been able to enter into a joint venture which will just get them on the bottom rung of the farming ladder. Scotland's Land Matching Service was launched by the Rural Economy Secretary Fergus Ewing at Waterside Farm near Dunblane, and Ewan McElraith was there.
We're launching a land matching service, and the idea is that the average age of a farmer in Scotland is 60, and many are kind of stuck. They may want to retire, they may be getting on a wee bit, not able to milk the cows in the morning as they used to, but having difficulty in finding a purchaser or really a successor. Maybe their kids have moved to take on salary jobs elsewhere. So matching a farmer that wants to retire with a young person or couple that want to come in is the idea. So we're bringing together people that want out and people that want in, and we're providing an advisor, because this is not just about matching the land, it's about fitting the people. They have to be able to like each other, get on with each other, work with each other in partnership. This is an exciting new venture in Scotland. I think it's got potentially a great future. And with a sort of Team Scotland, all the NFUS, the landowners, the tenants, will all try together to make it work.
Robin Young, dairy farmer at Waterside Farm for the last 20 years. Been dairy farmer all my life and now semi-retired, heading towards retirement.
How big a decision was that to go into a partnership or a contract with somebody else?
It started by the fact I needed a new hip in 2012 and I decided I wasn't going to milk cows.
With a new... Dairy farming's hard work.
Well, yeah, it takes its toll, maybe too much rugby as well, but anyway. And we were going to sell up and retire. Didn't work because of financial constraints for prospective buyers. And it was suggested to us that there were other options out there. So we did quite a bit of homework and research and found that the contract farm concept maybe fitted what we wanted to do. And we went down to England on 4 different occasions to go to seminars, visit people who were already doing this. We then recruited a consultant who came and visited us here to see, in his opinion, our farm setup was suitable for contracting, and did budgets, planning for profit exercises to come up with a business plan before we even looked for a contractor.
So how does the kind of matching scheme work? Do they just kind of, is it like a dating agency?
It was really done word of mouth that we were actually advised not to advertise. Farmer who was a contractor down south said someone will come out of the woodwork, and lo and behold, someone did come out of the woodwork.
My name is Patrick Kimpton and we're contract farming at Waterside Farm near Dunblane.
Now you're a young guy, why did you want to get into farming?
I always have farming in my blood. My grandfather has a tenancy on the Chumley estate down in Cheshire, so I always had a passion for farming, and any projects throughout my school life I always tried to get farming in there.
Passion's the easy bit, getting a farm's a hard bit, and this is a big farm.
Yeah, well, we were very lucky. I mean, I always thought that I'd have to settle for a farm manager's job or a herdsman job because I love my cows, but we were fortunate enough to come across a contract farming situation and have a farm owner to work alongside him. And the big thing for us is get on the farming ladder.
Because you presumably found it quite difficult up to this point.
You've got big aspirations, and me and my wife were both pretty driven, and we always like to think that we're achieving stuff. So when this came along, you know, we just threw ourselves at it, and you know, we always put 110% in. If you're not a farmer's son or daughter, and you haven't got a farm in line for you to take on, you know, you have to prove yourself to gain the respect within the industry to work alongside farm owners that want to give people, you know, like us, the opportunity.
Stephen Young, Scottish Land and Estates.
Stephen, how difficult is it for young folk to get a farm of their own to work on?
It is difficult, and I think that's part of the issue, and it's what we're doing here is looking at different models and saying, well, is there another way we can do things? Things just free up opportunities for new entrants, and also give them some information and the skills they need to take those opportunities and really see the benefits for everyone again.
Because it's a big, I've said it a few times, it's a big risk for a landowner or a farm owner to A, let go, and B, decide who's going to run it for you.
Yeah, it is. As part of a joint venture, you share the risk, and that's one of the key things. You share reward, we also share risk, so it's not all on one party. In terms of giving up control, as part of a joint venture or contract farming agreement, the farm owner still is involved in the day-to-day stuff. They're still involved in the management decisions. It's not just renting out and walking away. You're actually still involved, and it works really well for young entrants to give them that mentoring service as well. So they bring certain skills, the landowner brings certain skills, and between them they can make a successful business.
Andrew Thin, Chairman of the Scottish Land Commission.
Andrew, what's the situation about tenancies and all this? How would that work?
So I see this as a really good opportunity for secure tenants who are getting to a point where they might want to retire or semi-retire, because there's no reason why a joint venture between a tenant and a young person shouldn't be perfectly viable and perfectly successful. It doesn't have to be the owner.
That would surprise a lot of people. Because you would think it had to be the owner that could come to that decision.
Because traditionally we've thought of joint ventures as being landlord and tenant. But actually there is a whole range. We probably don't really know yet exactly how many different kinds of joint ventures we could have. But once we start thinking in this more imaginative and innovative way, then it opens up opportunities for tenants and landlords and who knows, possibly other arrangements. We don't know.
Because there's obvious benefits of getting more young people in. But part of the problem, as you well know, in tenancies, is how do you get out of this?
Of course there's benefits for young people, but it's also hugely beneficial for elderly tenants to be able to retire with dignity and either wind down or indeed come out of the work and just operate as a relatively sleeping partner in a joint venture. But this absolutely is about the dignity of tenants just as much as anything else.
Because a lot of tenants have been stuck in it, nowhere to give the farm to because they feel trapped. And this would just free up for everybody.
Yes, they aren't trapped. They can come out to the tenancy, but that may mean them leaving the farmhouse, where they've probably brought up a family and may even have lived for several generations. So it's psychologically very difficult. And this is another way, I think, and an important opportunity for some tenants, not all.
So the tenant farmer could keep the house and still be in a joint venture with a younger farmer?
You can imagine that happening very well, yeah.
How important is it to have schemes like this that can put those that have the land and those that want to farm it together?
Yeah, well, I've said this since we started the contract. This needs to be something that's broadcast across the UK because you drive around the UK and there's a lot of land that I see going to waste, and there's a lot of fellas sitting on it that haven't got the energy to do it anymore. I know that they wish they did, and there's a lot of young people in the industry, although they say there's not many coming forward, but there is a lot out there that just need to give them the chance and need the help and guidance to match the two together.
How important is it to get it to work? Because as you touched on it, we've got a really ageing farming population. You have a huge number of young people desperate to get out there and be farmers, but there's big financial hurdles in the way as well.
Well, there are, because it takes a lot of money, to buy a herd of cattle or buy a farm, a huge amount of money, and that's something that very few people can just raise like that. So a joint venture, a contracting basis, a shared partnership, there's many different business models, but that's why advice is required. We will make sure the advice is available. And for those farmers out there who are thinking, well, I'd quite like to find a route for succession, find someone to take on the task. Help is out there.
So worked out okay for you?
Yes. I'm now semi-retired. I don't do a lot of physical work. I run the business. In my early 70s now, I've got what I like as a good work-life balance. We're not tied as we were as dairy farmers for 40 years of our marriage. We were tied to dairy cows.
The government's rolling this out as a service for potential farmers and existing farmers. What do you make of it?
I think it's a good idea. It's not for everyone. It's quite a difficult adjustment for a landowner to see someone else running their farm. I wouldn't say it's always easy. The key element, I think, is to have trust and faith in one another. Both parties must trust, respect and have faith in what the other party is doing. There will be differences, but you can sit round and iron these out.
Ewan at the launch of the Farm Matching Scheme, and he spoke to Robin Young, Patrick Kimpton, Stephen Young, Andrew Thane and Fergus Ewing. Must be difficult, though, when you've had a patch of land and you've been accustomed to doing things your way and somebody else comes in and they're doing it just nae quite right.
Or just differently, maybe better.
Same thing.
Maybe better.
Could be. It's always a possibility.
I think it's a great opportunity for actually the younger and older generation to interact.
Yes.
And look at farming methods, because a lot of farming methods are now being returned to, aren't they? Because as a way of using less fertiliser and chemicals, pesticides in production, that's going back to the rotation model, for example.
And it's interesting that that's been driven largely by economic grounds, because fertilisers, pesticides, insecticides, etc., are just so expensive. The inputs going in are not being matched by what people are actually getting for what they're producing.
Yeah, and also the impact on the environment potentially as well.
So what might change in the future to make us pay the right amount for food?
That is a very big question.
It's a very, very big question.
Something actually we might explore.
Yeah.
Soon.
Yeah.
I think.
Worth a go.
Yep.
Anyway, we've had a bit of communication.
Yes, so this is the Scotland Outdoors podcast, and we always like to talk about, or share information actually, about where people listen from. You can always email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, and that's what Brendan Burns did. Mm-hmm. He got in touch last week to say he was listening to last week's programme, that was actually our live programme, from Sopot in Poland. And so we were intrigued, where is Sopot? What kind of place is it?
Everyone knows that.
Well,
the Riviera of Poland, sure.
You've just given it away. He didn't know that. He's pretending. It's a seaside resort in northern Poland, a spa town. It boasts the longest wooden pier in the world, 515.5 metres, stretching out into the Bay of Good dance.
Can I just say, just in case that excites you and you think, I must go to the longest pier in the world at 515.5 metres.
Yes.
It's a swick.
I know.
It does a dog leg.
We
it goes
it
so
up.
Far out and then it hangs a right.
Well, Sarah Duffy got in touch and said she loved hearing us talk about Sopot. Mm-hmm. And she says we were there with friends in April. It's known as the Polish Riviera.
That's how I knew that.
Just a short train journey from Gdańsk, as well as the pier, it has a wonky building. Well worth a visit.
I was watching somebody on the telly the other day, and I can't remember where they were, but it was a church with a seriously wonky spire. It was built, and for all the world, it looked like an ice cream cone that had been caught in a strong wind. It was just way off to one side, and you thought, why? Why would you build something like that? Unless it was built with green timber, which then warped and twisted into that shape. I don't know.
These are the kind of things that you think about as you wander around Scotland gathering material.
As I lie awake staring into the dark in the middle of the night. As we've just been saying, we do like hearing when you get in touch, especially to highlight what's going on in your part of the country. The other week, the Ancrum District Heritage Society and the Borders emailed us to, and I quote here, offer the opportunity to forsake your northern realms. It's obviously someone with a literary twist. To forsake your northern realms, to delve into the deep south. Turns out that Heritage Society members were assisting experts in the middle of an archaeological dig at a palace. An Ancrum. I couldn't refuse. Richard Strathy was my guide.
We're here at this site of the Mantle Walls, where we think there is the Bishop of Glasgow's palace.
Okay, obvious question. The Bishop of Glasgow's palace, why would it be in Ancrum? Why is it not in Glasgow?
Okay. First of all, a palace is literally just a place where the bishop stayed. The Bishop of Glasgow had a palace here because this is the old kingdom of Strathclyde. Comes all the way down to the Tweed here. So he was here because this was a very productive part of Scotland. This was a very, rich part of Scotland. He controlled the land from here to Glasgow.
What you've got essentially here is an L-shaped excavation. A couple of dozen people working here. I can see the remains of a wall. Introduce me to Jessica.
Okay.
And she's one of the archaeologists here.
Jessica's the head archaeologist on site. So she tells us all what we can do and sometimes what we're not to do.
Let's put that down. Stop it. Hi, how are you doing?
Hi there.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Talk me through this from a professional standpoint. What have we got in front of us?
Okay, so in 2012, there were some limited excavations carried out after they did some geophysics on the site to try and pinpoint whether they've got buildings here that possibly relate to the Bishop's Palace. What we are intending to do here is to build on those excavations and try and open up a bit more to try and ascertain the date and function of the buildings that we've got here.
You've got a big lump of wall here in front of us. Again,
yep.
It's the usual problem. When confronted by a hole and a rickle of stains, as a layman, I'm desperately trying to visualise what might have been here, how big it might have been. How imposing a building was this, do you know?
The bishop's palaces that we've got remaining in Scotland, so Spiney Palace up in Moray, is definitely quite extensive. And there's no reason to suggest that the palace here at Ancrum was not extensive. So what we've done is last week we had a ground penetrating radar survey carried out, and that seemed to indicate that the top part of the field is actually covered with quite a large building, so about 18 metres wide at least. And it's also bringing up some ancillary buildings to the northwest, and we've also got one in our trenches to the east.
How did this get lost? How did you lose something that size?
Well, after obviously the Reformation, these big buildings fall out of use. So unless there's somebody that wants to take them over as a grand house, they get robbed out for stone, left unroofed, and people come and nick all the stone from them. They fall into ruin, they fall down, plough goes over them, and all of a sudden they're under the ground, and only the people in the village or people that know of the historical records of them can find them.
How did the local villagers know there was something here? Why did they suspect there was something here?
There's always been tales in the village of a big building here, and it was called the Mantle Walls, and we really can't get a good handle on what that is. There's always been big stones come off this field, lots of big stones. And there's always been, the occasional find. There's been metalwork finds. And a couple of people in the village started divining and they've thought they could trace the walls and stuff. So there's always been this impetus to find what is here.
You've obviously opened up the ground and found the remnants of these walls. Are you finding anything else other than stone?
Yes, we've got some evidence of occupation on the site in form of there's lots of animal bone and pottery mixed in with the demolition rubble. We're not getting an awful lot of in-situ deposits, so looking at occupation layers. So we're hoping that we're getting down onto that now, and that will be able to tell us a little bit about what was happening in these buildings.
This is Roy.
How are you doing, Roy?
Hiya.
Why did you volunteer to take part in this?
I volunteered just through natural interest. I've always had a lifetime interest. It's a contrast of experiences I've had. Ex-steel worker from the Ravenscraig 30 years ago, brought the children down here. They have room to live down here, and it was the best move we ever made. But my interest is not so much in the archaeology or the history of the area. It's about people and communities and how they relate to the archaeology and the history of their area. The Eye Kent, there was a bishop's palace here, but they don't really know the size of this structure compared to comparison with the village.
Has it surprised you?
It's amazed me, is the word. We have artist's impressions, just doodling away of how big this building was on the ridge. But when you look at these artist's impressions, Mark, they're garden sheds compared to what's here today. Yeah. It gives you an insight. If you look at that wall there, look at the backfill in that. It's packed in there. They had people to do it. They had money to do it. They had resources to do it. Just wee things like that tell you the status of this site. You might think perhaps that the Ancrum village is a sleepy wee place off the A68, 5 miles north of Jedburgh. You'd be wrong. It's a wide awake village, 5 miles north of Jedburgh. It's the school children from the local school, from Denham, from Lily's Leaf and from Ancrum. When the Ancrum guys came the other day there, lovely sunny weather, the archaeologists show them the artefacts, they tell them what we're doing, they get them to sieve. So when they were sieving, they came across three shards of green glazed crockery. When you tell them it's 700 years old, and they're the first to see that, you don't know if they're comprehending what you're telling them. But we had a nice thing on Saturday. We had one of the great grannies come back to tell us, to thank us, for her granddaughter having a lovely time with the school, and that now she wants to be an archaeologist. That does it all for us. They're the generation that's taking our past into their future. That's what I get out of history. It's putting people together with their heritage.
Do you want to show me the palette of goodies?
Oh, Alice is lifting it out for you there.
Hey.
It's beautiful.
That's rather a lovely piece of work, isn't it? That's really unusual.
It's a beautiful piece of carved masonry.
It's almost like a fleur-de-lis across the top, except instead of a single stem, it's almost like two legs coming out of it at the bottom, and there are several of them.
Mm-hmm.
When you find something like this, how do you feel?
Pretty good. You'll have to ask Alistair about that, because he's the one that found it.
When I found this stone, it was flat on the ground like this.
Uh-huh.
Just looked like any ordinary stone, and then when we were digging down the side of it, here we find what appeared to look like cogs.
Uh-huh.
So it is quite like a cog wheel, isn't it?
It's like a mill wheel or something.
It looks like a mill wheel with stone cogs on it. But when we eventually got out of the ground, you can see it's something special. I'm not sure what it is. It's like gingerbread men.
It is like... Certainly the one in the front looks like a gingerbread man.
There's always been speculation that there was a big building here, but hopefully now people have got to start believing how high status and big a building it was.
Tell me who you are and what your role was in this.
I'm Chris Bowles. I am the Council Archaeologist for Scottish Borders Council. And I first came across this site in around 2010 when somebody in the village here told me about metal detecting going on in here and big stones being pulled up by the plough. So I came in and had a look. Within half an hour, I had medieval pottery in my hand. And then when I kind of realized what we had, I decided, well, we need to do something about this. This is a significant place, a significant building, and we might have to, you know, start thinking about doing some archaeology so we can protect it.
People know about ground-penetrating radar and things like that, but is it true that you actually used divining rods in this at one stage?
I didn't know. There's a chap in the village who was using divining rods on it, and he's really the reason we're all here, actually, because he knew about the stones, and he's actually the person who got in touch with me about it.
What we were looking at, Jessica and I, earlier, across there, you know, it's obviously the base of a wall. It's very impressive. This is nothing short of gorgeous. I mean, this is a fabulous level of work.
Yeah.
Quality of work.
Absolutely. It's gorgeous on two levels. On the one level, that it survives in a ploughed field, that you have, you know, basically, what is that, about a metre and a half worth of depth of masonry. And on the other level, that it's so well constructed. You know, we're talking about top quality builders building this building. I'm assuming this is the Bishops of Glasgow. They have enough money to basically rival the abbeys in the region for this building for its architecture.
From start to finish, to get to this stage has taken you 9 years. Mm. Worth it, though.
Yes, it's definitely a highlight of my career, being able to find something like this and actually being able to preserve something like this for the region. And for Ancrum, you know, it's a tiny village, but to give it something like this as part of its history, you know, is just tremendously rewarding. And to think that, you know, this is now going to be known, Ancrum is going to be known for its Bishop's Palace. You know, that's something that I think everybody can be proud of.
Chris Balls there, and many thanks to Chris, Richard, Jessica, Roy, Alistair, and indeed everyone who spoke to me from the fascinating visit to the Bishop's Palace in Ancrum.
So the Bishop would have had a palace all the way down there, even
yes,
though he was a Bishop of Glasgow.
It was part and parcel of the Kingdom of Strathclyde, or Strathclota at the time, yeah. So, and it was better ground, as he was saying.
And they would have just travelled by horse, presumably, to get
there. Horse, carriage, yeah, possibly. Mm. You know, it would have been kind of bumpy in a carriage. You know, the roads would have been pretty primitive, I would have thought.
Yeah.
This time of year is absolutely perfect to visit Perthshire. Big tree country. It's got fabulous autumn colours and it's a very, very popular location. One of the most popular locations, actually, to go and look in the view is the Garry Bridge near Pitlochry. As Ewan's been finding out, the bridge has a very interesting history. Local councillor Michael Williamson, explain more.
We're walking on the old road to the Isles before the construction of the Garry Bridge.
So we're just halfway between Blairathal and Pitlochry. We're walking down this old road. It's kind of hard to believe it once was the main route.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, and when you look at it now, it's hard to believe that all the traffic went up and down it.
And we're just coming up to a green footbridge, but it's on the... In fact, it's pretty muddy a little bit. We'll go around the puddles here. Beautiful wee bridge. And it's on the foundations of a much earlier bridge.
Yeah, the original bridge was built in the 1700s and was demolished in the mid-1950s and replaced by Bailey Bridge, which took the traffic in it initially, until they decided what to do as a long-term solution, and they built the Garry Bridge.
Because we're just going to look up to the Garry Bridge at the moment. We've got the river actually pounding away below us, white foam, really dark, peaty-coloured water. And we're looking back to the Garry Bridge. What's so special about the Garry Bridge?
Well, it was the first box girder bridge that was built in Perth and Kinross in 1967, 68, 69. It was constructed. It's subsequently become quite an iconic bridge, and I think for me, it was never officially opened at the time. And it'd be nice just to celebrate this view and draw attention to
it. Because this is a compulsory stop for anybody coming to the Highlands. You have to stop here and take a photograph.
Yes, of course. And I think that's the beauty of this bridge, isn't it? It was put in as a bridge to replace an old bridge. And suddenly, as I say, it's become this iconic beauty spot that everybody has to stop and take a photograph of, especially during autumn at this time of year.
Yeah, because the trees are just beginning to turn. And you get a real sensation, A, of the height of the bridge, and B, the height of the trees. They are massive.
That's correct, yeah. It's hard to believe, and you've got people bungee jumping off the top of that as well, haven't you? Mm-hmm. So it's quite a feat of engineering just to go over that bridge.
But they did get it wrong when they were building it.
Yeah, they I believe they used two different data points. So when they were constructing it and it came to meet up, there was something like a 2-foot difference in the heights of the bridge, you know.
It is truly incredible. In the half hour I've been standing here, there's been piles of cars just stopping and taking a photograph.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, isn't it? It is actually unbelievable. I mean, when they originally made it, they put a car park in with enough space for 50 cars, but when you look at it nowadays, at the peak of autumn colours, I mean, you can barely get a car parking space for it.
And it really is truly an impressive span, but hard to believe they didn't have an official opening, though.
No, I suspect they probably wanted just to keep it quiet because of the mix-up with the construction of it. You know, I think there was an awful lot of reputations that had been messed up by it.
So what celebrations have you got planned? Well, we've got for the official opening at last, 50 years on.
We've got a civic reception on the 26th of October, and I've managed to find as many of the people who actually built the bridge as I can locally. So we've invited them along to a civic reception, and for this green footbridge that was put in place just after the opening of the big bridge.
Because this is a really important route, isn't it? This is the proper road to the island.
Yes, of course it is. I mean, it's a lovely, lovely route, isn't it? You know, and I think it's a shame that the road road is so narrow, but you know, when you think about Queen's Yew and Loch Rannoch and Loch Arbour beyond there, it's just unbelievable. And it's got its own song, you know.
But it's a kind of meeting place of the two great routes in Scotland.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the Great North Route, haven't you, between Inverness, Perth and Edinburgh, and then you've got this road that connects the road to the Isles. And I think when this bridge was constructed, they were actively talking about connecting Rannoch Station to Glencoe.
That would have been good.
Yeah, it certainly would have been. I mean, there were options being looked at, you know. I'm not sure whether they'd get away with it now, but they were actively discussing how they could connect to the east to the west.
It's a lovely bridge. It's an iconic bridge. It's lasted really well. But the design had problems in other parts of the world.
Yeah, it's a box girder bridge, and shortly after this was opened, they had to close it again in the early 1970s to strengthen it up because of two bridges collapsing in Melbourne and Merthyr Tydfil at the time. So they were box girder bridges as well. So, as I say, they had to strengthen the bridge up.
What about this one we're on? This is a cute wee bridge.
Yeah, this was a footbridge that was put in at the time in partnership with the National Trust and the Council at that time, and was actually just lowered in with two cranes from either side of the river. I don't know how these...
That must be quite an operation.
I would think so, yes, but it's actually sat on the foundations of the old bridge, and if you look actually over, you can actually see the old bridge just down there.
Because they've made a lot of bridges at this point, and a ferry as well.
Yeah, there was a ferry at one point.
That must have been a bit scary.
I would imagine so. And I believe there was a guy in the past who came down with his horse and cart down the old road, and his horse lost a footing, and the two of them ended up down in the river, drowned. So
into the ferry.
And probably the ferry, so probably that's why the bridge got put in. But the original bridge was put in the 1700s.
Do you think folk are aware of the history of the Garry Bridge?
Probably not. And I think that's...
I'm guilty.
Yeah, I think that's partly why I'm trying to commemorate the 50th anniversary of this bridge. I think it is important. And the Pass of Killiecrankie that it sits at the entrance to has got a huge history, you know, a huge wealth of history.
Michael Williamson there, and the civic reception for really quite a belated opening of the Garry Bridge is at the end of this month.
Do you like a bridge?
Oh, I like a bridge too. I'm actually quite interested in underneath bridges.
Oh, yeah.
What is it about underneath bridges that's so fascinating?
The echo?
Yeah, sometimes. They don't always have an echo right enough. But no. It's that feeling of, you know, being underneath things. What was that story again? The Billy Goat Gruff? Billy Goat's Gruff. And there was the troll underneath the bridge.
Yes.
I just fancy myself as the troll, that's all.
That's what you could do when you retire. You could become a
professional working on it.
Troll.
Not an online troll. No, this is a different kind of troll altogether. Yeah.
Well, you've heard of Banksy.
Oh, yes. I'm down with the kids.
Yeah,
I know about
what
these
that
things.
Is. And that's the fact that works of art pop up in all sorts of unusual places spontaneously. And there's the Stonehaven Banksy. Have you heard of that?
Yes. So, I actually photographed that the other day, actually. I don't know if we've put it up on our Facebook page, but we should.
Yeah, so sculptures, basically, around the town that keep
different
appearing.
Different kinds. Absolutely perfect little models of fishing boats done in stainless steel, welded up, but they're crewed by fish and lobsters and skate. And,
so know, there's a bit of satire in there. Yeah. Well, there's another one. There's more secret art, I believe, and you've been checking it out.
I was really quite taken by this. I heard about it and went along to Arbroath Cliffs in the company of Cameron Smith, who runs a company called Scottish Adventures. He even brought his guitar.
So now we're heading up to the musical notes that appeared on Arbroath Cliffs. So no one knows where they came from. They just appeared one day, and it's still a mystery as to who made it.
I'd heard about this, but I've never seen it before. It's extraordinary. Fantastic view. I mean, today, blue skies, puffy clouds. It's like beaten silver across there on the sea. And because this part of the coastline is just riddled with sea cliffs, it's really dramatic. But on this wee point of headland, because this is not a 5-minute job. Somebody's done a really good job on this.
Yeah, it's very professional, yeah.
Because what essentially you've got is, it's like a fence, but it's like musical staves, top and bottom. Does that actually make sense musically?
Well, what you're seeing, it's a piano score for Lord of the Dance.
And you've no idea who put this up?
It's still a mystery, still a mystery.
You must have some clue, surely.
There's none at all. No, no idea.
But how could someone get this into the ground? So let's have a quick, close look at it. Into the ground. Because they've cemented this in. Oh, no, they haven't. No, they haven't. What they've done, they've driven it into the turf and then they've used that post-crete stuff.
Yeah, that's
right. Ah, that'll do, though. But this is really nicely made, because I mean, essentially, they've made the framework, the staves and things, and then they've galvanised that, so it's not going to rust up here, and then all the notes, I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order, are painted black. It's really dramatic.
So whoever built it, obviously they're very skilled at metalwork, mm-hmm. but they also have to have a knowledge of music, because mm-hmm. the notes are all completely correct.
You're not confessing to this, are you?
Maybe not. Maybe. No, it wasn't me. It's still a mystery.
And just behind this, we're probably 70, 80 feet above the sea. There's a strong offshore breeze at the moment, so you've got seagulls dancing across the water. It's in a real turmoil amongst these really quite pink rocks. And this great big Thumber Rock. Has that got a name?
The Deal's Head.
The Deal's Head. Every time I pass that, I think, how much longer can that stay up? But why Lord of the Dance? Why here?
That's still a mystery. No one's sure yet. No one knows.
There's something about... I mean, somebody at the moment is kind of doing drive-by art. There's art yes. popping up all around this area. Is it likely to be the same person?
Possibly. Right. Possibly. So, it was about a month ago, there was a mysterious man appeared in our local pond, Kepti mm-hmm. Pond. So it must have been about 4 a.m, woke up the next day and there's this man that they've now called the Mirror Man, uh-huh. similar to the one that used to be in Loch Earn.
Because it was kind of like a disco ball, it was covered in little mirrors.
Yeah, so it was kind of like reflective type of material. Right. And it lasted about 3 or 4 days, it brought loads of people to the pond, uh-huh. lots of families out, and then it just disappeared one night. So that was about a month ago, and then it was only about 2 weeks ago this just appeared out of nowhere. And again, no one has made claim to this at all.
Have the council got a view on this?
I have no idea. No one's asked. No one's asked the council.
No one asked permission. Nobody asked the council afterwards. No. They didn't even phone up to apologise. But it is just, you know, it's an extraordinary piece of work. Somebody's invested money in this and riveted it together, because it's held together by rivets. I'm just so impressed by this. It's a fantastic piece of work.
One of the things I like most about it, because when we heard about the music notes that were along the cliffs, the first thing that came to my mind was, oh no, it might take away from the view, mm-hmm. you know, because usually like an art installation can ruin a view, like uh-huh. a railing or something. Uh-huh. But as you can see, it adds to yeah. the view. So it's whoever's made it has put it in a great position. Yeah,
for some reason your eye doesn't stop at it, your eye kind of travels through it and you just get this vista behind it. Good on whoever did it. Can you play this?
Yes. So the music that's there on the top of the cliffs is actually piano music, but I've not brought my piano with me.
Cannot get the staff these days, you really can't.
However, I do have my guitar.
Cameron Smith there, and his pretty nifty guitar playing of Lord of the Dance.
I think he's involved, don't you?
I did put it to him, and he denied it.
Yeah.
But not with any great conviction, I felt.
Mm.
He'd be a rubbish poker player, I'm telling you.
But I do like this spontaneous artistic expression.
Yeah. No, I do too, actually. You know, there's just... It's not just the fact that it's like guerrilla art, it just kind of pops up every so often, but... It's the fact that people want to enhance the landscape. And I struggle to think of an example of, you know, this kind of guerrilla art which hasn't enhanced its landscape. I can think of quite a few examples of civic art which did exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
You stuck up and you thought, why? Why on earth would you put that there? But this guerrilla stuff seems to be more, I don't know, sensitive, in tune with, beats me. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week's Scotland Outlaws podcast. We will be back with one midweek because you were out with a very interesting group of people.
Yeah, so I spent some time with a bunch of women who were on a course run by the Venture Trust, and they take people into rural settings who have suffered extreme trauma or mm-hmm. addiction, various problems in their life, and use the outdoor setting to help them work through their problems. So that will be on our midweek podcast.
Yeah. So, don't miss it. From all of the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for downloading us.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.